Hello, and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who are recovering from their various weeks and weekends. Anyways, we're your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. Today, we are talking about neurodivergence with a special guest that we have, Charisma Starr. Charisma is someone whom I have a lot of personal respect for. She is known in our industry to be just a thought leader in general, but what people don't always know until you've had the chance to get to know her is what just a genuine and kind-hearted person she is. Charisma has been in the legal industry for almost 25 years. She started her career at Kirkland & Ellis, helping build their litigation support department. And as a founding member, she was instrumental in product development and the early days of customer support at Reveal Software. She spent the next 10 years in Fortune 100 companies and on the speaker circuit as an advocate for industry innovation and transformation. An industry thought leader, she is currently a member of various technology advisory boards, an ACC interest group lead, an ILTA content creator, and the EDRM 2.0 corporate project trustee, which is what Angie and I get to participate in with her as well. In the last year, her focus has become conversations about how we can improve the mental health and overall well-being of the neurodiverse through collaboration and empathy. She is here today to discuss that topic. Charisma, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Sure. Well, I got to see Charisma last week. I got a little bit spoiled. We got to have some fantastic Italian food at a place that I go to every year when I go to Legal Week called Becco. We dined on your behalf, Angie.
I know. I have such FOMO for not being at Legal Week.
Yeah, I definitely had a martini for you as well.
Oh, good. I would expect nothing less.
But I was curious what your favorite things are to do in New York. I mean, of course, Legal Week's always fun to go to, but really what is fun for me is the food, of course. But there's things in New York City I enjoy doing too. So Charisma, what do you enjoy doing in New York?
So eating is always a big one. But I think everyone enjoys that in New York. I really like jazz a lot. So I try to take in a jazz show when possible. New York for me, you know, it's so busy, can be a little draining. So I do my fair share of just kind of chilling out in the hotel room. I try to find things like water fountains that I can sit by, anything that's more similar to nature, parks, you know, things like that as well.
Yeah, I'm a huge jazz music fan myself, so I can definitely relate to that. And you are very smart to take the time to decompress, because that's something I don't always do when I'm burning my candle at both ends and I regret it. What about you, Angie?
Oof, that's tough. So I think, first of all, actually the best jazz show I have ever seen was in New York at the Flatiron Room, I think, which is this little sort of, you like walk behind a velvet curtain kind of thing. The music was amazing. And then I had this smoked chicken that came under like a cloche full of smoke. And I still think about that chicken. And I'm pretty sure this was like 7 years ago. I think one of my favorite things to do in New York, though, is just honestly walking around meatpacking and walking the High Line. I love that.
Yeah. And there's such great people watching, too, in New York.
Oh, it's amazing. Okay. So before we move into this topic, we wanted to give a quick disclaimer, which is that we are not mental health professionals. We're here talking about this topic today through the lens of our own experiences as professionals and as members of the legal field. Any opinions, information, and topics that we discuss today, they're really deeply personal, definitely not a reflection of our companies or related to the work that we do for our respective companies. With that little bit of legalese out of the way.
Thank you, counselor.
Yeah, I think we could dive into the meats of it. I don't know. Are you guys ready?
I think so. Charisma, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Well, first, I know that the subject matter, like Angie just said, is highly personal. And I just think you ladies, and I feel honored to be on this call with you to also be sharing myself. But it takes a lot of bravery to talk about these things because it's personal struggle. It's personal obstacles that we've overcome and things that sometimes the world sees as a flaw. And I don't know that we should necessarily see it that way, but that's just my opinion. So when we think about the terms neurodivergent and neurotypical. Let's level set with a baseline here. What do those terms actually mean to you?
So neurodiversity, it can be considered a framework for understanding human brain function. And it considers the diversity within sensory processing, motor abilities, social comfort, cognition, and focus. And it considers them neurobiological differences. The diversity falls on a spectrum of neurocognitive differences, and the neurodiversity paradigm argues that diversity in neurocognition is part of humanity, and that some neurodivergences, generally classified as disorders such as autism, ADHD, etc., are actually differences with strengths and weaknesses as well as disabilities, and they're not necessarily pathological. Neurotypical individuals are those who fall within the average range of functioning and thinking, just meaning average, like more common, not necessarily better versus worse.
Well, thanks for that definition. I know that there are a lot of terms that are kind of thrown out in today's society about being on the spectrum and how big is the spectrum and can you kind of sort of be on the spectrum and does that mean that you're ADD or ADHD or autistic or whatever? Talk to us a little bit about that. You know, how do we wrap our mind around all the terminology and understand truly what neurodivergence actually means?
And it kind of depends on how you look at it. You know, neurodivergent individuals can be those that are considered autistic, ADHD, dyslexic, highly sensitive, gifted. They could have a high IQ, you know, they could have a low IQ. It just means you're kind of different from that average. What I found really interesting when I dig into this is that all of this presumes that there is a normal. But there is a sect inside of the neurodiversity movement that has studied history and science, and recognizes that normality itself is a construct. Some even believe that the idea of normality, similar to categorizations like race and sex, it's simply a way for one group to impose power and hierarchy over others. There are a lot of books that have been coming out, and we're seeing these more and more over the last, you know, 5-10 years. Books like Empire of Normality, The Myth of Normal, The Canary Code, even Ellie Middleton and Penguin Publishing's mainstream book, How to Be You, touch on these concepts in a way that's very similar to other books that talk about caste and talk about race. Another book in this camp that I found very, very interesting, it also has a movie, is Isabel Wilkerson's book called Caste. There's an entire movement that expands on these principles. And you can watch a lot of videos on Instagram. You can read a lot of articles and writings on Substack. And a lot of what people are saying is that all of these different categories, they're really a fabrication. You know, we're all diverse, we're all different, we all have different experiences. And I personally find that collaboration, cooperation, and just accepting everyone's differences is, you know, a path towards something better, a better future for everyone, not just those that are neurodivergent, but also those that are neurotypical, because we are all different and deserve respect.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you on that as well. And I know Charisma just shared several different books. You know, she's very studied in this topic and is a wealth of information. I don't want you to stress out thinking that you're never going to hear these names again. We're going to put them in the show notes. So if you would like to have the names of these, please look there. And if you've got questions, you can always reach out to the eDiscovery Chicks and we can put you in touch with Charisma as well.
Yeah, I love this movement of what is normal. And maybe that's just a construct that doesn't really hold much water. One area where I've personally sensed a pretty stark difference between neurotypical people and neurodivergent people is filters. So my husband, who's neurotypical, and I, whom I'm neurodivergent, will often have the same set of inputs, but experience it very differently just because of the way that our brains process that input. And so in that way, I feel like neurodivergences can sort of act as filters. So have you experienced this? And if so, how do you deal with it? What do you believe? Are these disorders purely cultural or a construct, or are they real?
So it's interesting, right? Everything is real to the person experiencing it. And this is something that I've thought a lot about for a very, very long time. As a student of Buddhism and meditation, you know, I started at a pretty early age in my 20s to learn how to kind of question my thoughts, question my perceptions, try to look outside myself, look at kind of bigger pictures. You know, we can often, as humans, kind of get lost in our own perceptions, in our own environments. We arrive at different conclusions. We have different reactions based on our experience. And we can see things differently, right? Because of those experiences, because of, you know, it could be, you know, the way in which our minds work. It could be, you know, that I'm working in a corporate environment, you're working in a law firm environment, right? It could be that, you know, I'm from the suburbs of Chicago, or you're from, you know, the south side of Chicago, like my partner. You know, we see things and experience them differently because of who we are. And that's just part of being human. I think about perception, and I think about how do we surmount this, right? Especially in a world where, you know, many, what they're experiencing as truth, they fully believe it's the truth, and they're not looking at it from a different angle. It can be very, very difficult. I found that especially in the legal industry, it can be difficult because in e-discovery, in litigation, you know, there is this idea of sides, right? There's this idea of I'm right, you're wrong, we must defend this position. And folks get really, really good at working those muscles of defending a position. And it's very different from what I was just describing, where you're questioning, you know, do I really know everything that I need to know to do this well? Am I really looking at all the different angles? In litigation or e-discovery, you may look at all of the angles, but you're doing it to defend a position. And it's just such a different skill set. So I think that, you know, when you ask that question of perception, it can be very, very relevant to our industry.
Yeah, the idea of right and wrong really resonates with me and my own experience. And I know that there's a point in time when I had to realize for myself, you're kind of like a square peg trying to fit yourself into a round hole sometimes. People are taking you wrong. You keep having these experiences where you want to blame others, but it's happened enough to you at this point where you're like, somehow the common denominator seems to be Bree here, and I need to understand that a little bit more. When I started kind of diving into why I was having the same result, I needed to figure out what I was doing to cause that behavior on the other side. Like, why am I seeing this as a result of my own words or my own actions? And looking into that, I realized, wow, I really am neurodivergent, and I had no idea. And I felt scared. I felt a little bit betrayed. Like, did my parents see this and they tried to like shush it in me and I was like put in a box? I don't know. I mean, everything's your parents' fault. <It's the point>. You know, but I also felt excited. I felt understood for the first time. And there's a whole wealth of emotions that kind of ran through my head when I started, you know, diving into this myself. So what did that moment look like for you, Charisma? And what's your journey been since you've made that discovery?
Yeah, so I always knew I was different, you know, but I didn't really know what it was. And it wasn't until about 7 years ago that I really started to come to terms with the fact that I am actually neurodivergent and very different from some folks, we'll just say. At the time, I was trying to do what I would call success. I was trying to be successful. I had become, I think, pretty polished in my presentation ability, right? My ability to mask. So I was on the speaker circuit. I was going to a lot of dinners. I was doing a lot of traveling. I ended up getting married to someone who was really very different from me, but was in many ways, you know, a symbol of success because he, you know, had money, had an excellent career, valued high-end clothes and cars and all of those things. And I had been kind of avoiding that for a very, very long time. Even though it was within my reach, I'd been avoiding it. And I think, you know, I'd been avoiding it. I now realize because I am neurodivergent, I'd been hanging out with punk kids, and I've been hanging out with musicians and artists and people that were not as successful as myself in my industry. And I thought that what I was supposed to do, right, was do something different. I thought, well, okay, I'll give it a try. And at the time, I had a lot of energy, so I was able to like pass for a while. But ultimately, it ended in disaster because we were so very different. And he would misunderstand things going on with me. When I was on and I was giving him attention and I was charming, everything was cool. But when I was exhausted because we had been traveling and gone to some parties and like, you know, I had spoken at a conference or something, I came home and I was tired and I just wanted to like, you know, lay in bed or maybe do some yoga or read a book, he would actually get offended. Things to me that were self-care things that I had learned over the years were completely misunderstood because he didn't need to do them. He didn't need downtime. If I would zone out while working and be really, really focused, hyper-focused in my work and not hear him, he would get really upset. Like, I didn't care. It's like, I didn't hear him. I'm ADHD. But we didn't know, right? And when I first started realizing, I think I'm autistic, I'm ADHD. I remember telling people, like starting to tell people, and it was like, no, you're not, you know, and there is that pressure to hide it. And looking back, I realized that that's what my family has been doing their whole lives, generation to generation, because we are smart, because we are attractive, we have been hiding it. And I find it incredibly sad after ending this relationship, because I realized that it wasn't for me. I started getting tested. And the first thing I did was I went to Ammon Clinic. And they do brain scans. They test for all different things. And it's not your typical psychological testing. So it came with kind of a disclaimer of, well, you need to go do this for real later. But I went in 2020, end of 2020, early 2021. They did do a battery of tests. They interviewed my first ex-husband. And I did all sorts of online tests and answered a lot of questions. And they came back and they said, you know, we think it's autism, OCD, and ADHD. And I had never considered ADHD. Because, you know, you think of hyperactivity. I was never hyperactive. I was sitting there in class. I was a good girl. You know, I was paying attention. I did great in school. I was very quiet. Well, there's this thing called inattentive ADHD, which is usually what happens to a lot of women because mm-hmm. they need to be good. So you still have a lot of the same things going on, but you're just sitting there and you're zoning out and quiet. And if you're smart, you can pass. And you'll still hear what's going on with the teacher, and then you can answer the question, and no one knows.
You guys can't see us, but we can see each other, and there's like head nods all around happening right now. Like, yep.
I mean, sometimes I just share like the bare minimum of what's going on inside my head with my husband, and he's like, "What is it like to be in there?" I'm like, it's chaotic.
Yes, I have the same experience with my husband. He's like, wow, that's so much. So much is in there.
It's really interesting. And, you know, when I was in my 20s, I remember reading about monkey mind, right, in Buddhism, where you try to calm that. And I actually did. And I don't know. I think it's like a hybrid, like multiple reasons or ways in which I was able to do this. But through meditation, through questioning thoughts and pushing them away, through really just listening to my body and myself and using those self-care techniques, I found that generally, unless I'm stressed, my mind is really quiet. Like it's very quiet. And then when I need information, I get the answers. I remember being a little kid and I read a lot, you know, and when you read, you get that opportunity to kind of see inside of others' brains almost, right? Because you might have a narrator that's talking through a thought process. And I remember being pretty young, maybe like 7 or 8, and realizing I don't have a linear thought process. It's like I'll work on a problem and information comes to me and I feel like I'm not quite there yet. Like I can tell when I'm there and it's right and it's true. I can tell when it's not. And maybe I keep talking to people and I keep studying, learning things. Maybe I take a nap or I go to sleep and I wake up and I have the answer. Like it's not a linear process. I also remember from an earlier age realizing that I had made the decision to not talk. Like I'm not going to talk. I'm going to sit here and I will say something when it's necessary or I have something important to say because otherwise, it's super stressful for me.
Mm-hmm.
I have a processing delay, so it takes me a moment to hear things and take it in and get it inside into my brain with the rest of the information. It might take me a moment. So I found it's not best for me. I shouldn't just react. I should usually wait. And that can be misinterpreted by people, I think, often
mm-hmm.
for something it's not.
Well, I think that it's very smart, Charisma, because there's people like me that just spout off exactly what's on their mind and usually regret most of it. So I'm like, wow, she's so smart and controlled and graceful. Like one day I'll grow up and be that too.
Or she's so traumatized.
I feel like it's such a journey, though. Like over the weekend, I was talking to a friend of mine who's she's a partner at one of those like, you know, white shoe, super fancy law firms. And she was saying, you know, she just realized, she was like, oh, I've been so in my head, like with my neurodivergence. And she was like, I just realized that other people don't process things the way that I do. And so her example of that was, you know, she's a very extroverted person. And like, that's how her anxiety manifests. And so she was saying she goes into this associate's office and he always seems very tense when she does that. And to her, that feels so normal. And she was like, oh, but for him, like his anxiety might manifest in a totally different way. And what I'm doing might really be just overloading his circuits right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting how introvert and extrovert also plays into a lot of the stuff too. Like I was talking to somebody last week about how I'm very introverted and they're like, you're a liar because you are constantly talking and you're constantly social. I'm like, no. Don't get confused. Like I grew up in a place where I would be in trouble if I wasn't verbal, number one, because if you're hosting, if you're the hostess, there's a way that you need to behave. And if you're at a social event, there's a way that you're supposed to behave. And none of that is to be a wallflower. And that's rude. And so I just became very, you know, extroverted. But also I love people and I love connecting people. And I have to like, you know, really communicate a lot to understand who somebody is and how they're ticking. And I'm genuinely interested in that. So that takes a level of being extroverted. But after a very short moment, my little wires in my brain start like smoking, like they're in like overdrive. It's like your car starts shaking, like, ah, you need to pull off the road. And if I don't, you know, respond with quiet, then I get very, very frazzled and I start doing things like constantly forgetting where my hotel room key is, which is what happened about 50,000 times last week. But that's another story for another day.
I am with you. Yeah, we only have so much energy, right? We get energy in different ways. I've for a long time, I considered myself an introvert. And I know that I get the energy usually for myself. Right. From relaxing or from, you know, self-care. But it's interesting. I also really like people and I can get energy from the right people. And not to say that there are wrong people because they're not. It's just right for me. Right. People mm-hmm. that there are people that can increase my energy. And then there are people that where it's kind of draining. So studying that has been something that I found very intriguing. And I think it can even vary time to time, right? I think they'll tell you, if you look at the science, present day science, there is no actual self. We're always changing. Who we are is different. I know that might sound crazy, but
no, I was just thinking, well, thank God I'm not stuck as the person I was when I was 22.
Oh God.
Right.
Yes. Well, that person was a bull in a china shop and was getting herself in trouble a lot.
Yup.
Me too.
So did you feel, like, I guess this question is to both of you. Did you feel a sense of relief or empowerment when you realized your neurodivergence? Or like, what was your, what was that journey like?
It was really great to have all of these questions answered. I will say my life has been very confusing. Like, how can you be someone that both is often incredibly popular and has so many friends, but also be such a villain, such a villain in her own story? Like, what, you know, and often being a villain that doesn't realize they're doing anything like villainous, right? You're just walking around being yourself and you say something truthful and everyone hates you suddenly. You know, once I started really digging in on it, so many things made sense. You look at it from this other lens and you're like, oh, that's what was going on there. And it just continues. And I'm just glad for me, I'm at this point where, you know, after I went to that Ammon clinic and I got tested, I went and did some additional testing. And that testing said that I am actually very empathetic and I am very good at reading people's faces and I'm really good with emotions. And that tester said, you're not autistic. But that was one tester's opinion. You know, people are still trying to figure all of this out. I had that same tester said I was gifted, but maybe I'm gifted in kind of unusual ways. I'm gifted with visual puzzles and I'm gifted with communication. I have a very high vocabulary. You know, I have a high capacity for intellectual thinking, but with my processing delay, I'm not fast. Working with New Yorkers over the last 2 to 3 years has been incredibly difficult for me because they value speed. And I'm more like a Texan, Brie, like my grandmother, I was telling you, grandmother. And when she moved just to the Chicago area, she was like, this is too fast, you know, because we are your traditional country healer type people. Right. And that's a whole different kind of intelligence. There are things that I understand or see that others don't see, and they're there. And there are things other people are doing and that they see and that they feel, you know, that I might miss or might think, oh, you know, that's nothing. That's no big deal. we're all different. So it was a sense of empowerment in a way, because now I understand why. It didn't necessarily make my life easier.
Mm-hmm. I can relate to that so much. And by the way, I've been asked if I'm from New York a lot, like working in Houston. Like, God, you talk so fast. I'm like, I don't know. Maybe I really am from New York. Maybe that's why I don't feel like I ever belong here.
I think there's a part of my soul that lives in New York for this exact reason.
I now know why I'm in Chicago and I've been staying here.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I often felt like I was from another country or I was from another world. Like, I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. And I remember thinking, this is bizarre because I have a very large family on both sides. My mom and my dad, they both have 5 children in their family. And then there's all these grandkids and whatnot. So every holiday, anytime we had together, there was tons of people, but I've never been more alone. And, you know, that was something that I could never understand about myself. Like, why do I not fit in? These are my own family. Like, I've never felt more uncomfortable in my skin. And, you know, I think kind of going back to what you were talking about earlier, Charisma, with the, you know, people feeling the need to hide who they are to fit into some social norm, and families building a legacy around that whole thought process, it like trickles down. And looking back on that whole experience, I understand it so much more now. Like, well, number one, you have the neurodivergent, you know, factor. Number two, you have the denial of a lot of your heritage that you were never told because there was a social norm that you needed to be. And so that helped me, really realize who I was. And that was relieving. So I love how you just said charisma. You know, it didn't make my life easier, but it was relieving to have answers. I think that that's a great statement that truly describes my own feelings. And I'm judging by Angie's nods that she agrees with that as well.
I do.
So let's talk about identifying and managing sensitivities. There's a concept of inputs and how these inputs can produce different reactions in neurodivergent people than they usually do with neurotypical people. Sometimes we call these triggers or sensitivities. Does that term resonate with you, Charisma? And if so, what does it mean exactly?
So for me, long ago, before I started identifying as neurodivergent, I identified as a highly sensitive person. So the word sensitive has always been something that, you know, I relate to. There's a book, Self-Care for Autistic People, that really does a great job of talking about the things that can impact an autistic person and how to care for oneself. I'm 49, right? I've been here for a long time. And we didn't have books like that when I was younger, right? We did have books about highly sensitive people, and they have a lot of overlap. So I do consider it sensitivities. I think, though, for autistics, and I'll touch on this in a little bit, I think that there is also a lot of trauma. So you could also use the word triggers, but I see that as something that's related but separate. It can be hard to weed out, you know, what is something I'm sensitive to and what is a trigger, a trauma response. Sometimes it can get confusing on a really bad day, but I think there are a couple different things going on there. The book Canary Code, which talks a lot about work, talks about our society and how our society is architected. There's also a book, Untypical, by Pete Wormby, that gets into this as well. Those books talk about the way in which society is set up or the environments we're in are set up, how they can negatively impact those that are neurodivergent. You know, they're designed for the average person. I am, in addition to being autistic, ADHD, I am left-handed. I've been dealing with that my whole life. Like, oh, I can't cut this because I don't have any scissors. My family were very accepting people. We let people be themselves. And they let me be myself, thankfully. They were hippies, right? They let me be left-handed, but I still couldn't find any scissors. So, if we look at just that, right, you're walking through a world that is not designed for you. You know, you go into the bathroom, things are in the wrong places. You walk through a door and your instinct is to do one thing and it's always the opposite and you look like an idiot, right? You know, imagine those things, but you're a very sensitive person. So the fluorescent lights, you deal with them, maybe you don't even realize that day in and day out, they're what's making you annoyed.
Okay, those are extremely activating.
Mm-hmm.
They are.
I cannot handle overhead lights of any sort.
Can lights, very activating.
Mm-hmm.
It can be hard, right? But in legal, I think one of the reasons so many neurodivergent gifted folks do so well, aside from being intelligent, right? There is this need to be perfect and to identify all of the things that are imperfect. And I did a great job of that when I was at the law firm. I was excellent at identifying things that are imperfect, having the foresight to see what's coming ahead that could be an issue. My mom taught me how to worry so well, so well. I mean, you can do really, really well in legal if you can identify the potential things that could go wrong and identify imperfection. But the reason that we're so good at it is that sensitivity.
Just for those of our listeners who maybe haven't experienced these kind of sensitivities or activators or triggers, are they standardized or are they individualized?
That's a good question. I think they are individualized. There are different things that upset different people. Food is a really good example. You know, if you're on the Instagram with a lot of autistics, people will talk about food that bothers them. That food can vary greatly. When we go out to eat, we have a group full of neurodivergent teenagers that tend to go out to eat with us. And it is not, you know, unheard of that they'll be like, so-and-so isn't going to eat anything. Like, you're just not going to eat because mm-hmm. your familiar food isn't here. Mm-hmm. Or we need to find a place that, you know, has X because, you know, so-and-so's kid will eat X. Tend to go to a lot of the same places all the time because it's comforting. Now, this is one of those things where I think some of it could be trauma. You don't want to deal with the unknowns. So you don't have the headspace to deal with that. You don't have the energy to deal with that. So you just do what you're used to because it's safe. And yeah. You see that in kids with trauma, too. I've been reading. I do read a lot. And I'm going to mention these books because I think they're helpful. There's this one I'm reading right now, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog.
Goodness.
And it's a book full of stories about little kids. There's also a more commonly known book, The Body Keeps the Score, about trauma. And there is, like I said, that overlap there. And it's, you know, it's stress, it's burnout in the legal industry. People might not want to mention it, but it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's trauma.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think kind of paying attention to some of these sensitivities has helped me understand why I get very irritable or anxious. And of course, my go-to emotion, just like some little child that I know that might be mine, is always anger. Like, why is all of a sudden am I angry? You know, like there's literally nothing to be angry about. But figuring out, oh, well, if I turn off all the lights and we have a lamp in the corner, I feel so happy about life. You know, finding those little things that, you know, we're sensitive to is really key in your own sanity.
Yeah, I think as far as maintaining your sort of equilibrium, managing sensitivities can be so critical to that. And I'm going to use that word, sensitivities, throughout this conversation. But what I mean by that is sort of broader. You know, if for you, listener, they're triggers or activators, I'm sort of using sensitivities as a catch-all term. I'm a very anxious person, which is a neurodivergence. I know it's not one that's often talked about, but it is. It changes the way that I view everything in my daily life. I manage that neurodivergence through a combination of medication and therapy, both of which have their fair share of stigmatization. So I want to make some space for us to talk about those two things, medication and therapy, and how impactful they can be. So Charisma, how have medication and therapy helped you manage your neurodivergence?
So this topic is one that I've changed opinion on over the years. And the reason why my opinion on both of them has changed is that when you are neurodivergent and you are a unique person, it can take a long time to find the right environment, the right partner, the right therapist, the right medication. When I was in my 20s, I first started experiencing what I now know is shutdown or burnout. And I hadn't had any real trouble when I was a kid because, like I said, my family is very accepting and they just let me do my thing. I spent a lot of the time at the library. The library is like my safe place. And it wasn't until my 20s when I started doing too much that I started to experience symptoms. And it's funny, you know, I used to think, you know, symptoms of, you know, my disorder, but it was really just the symptoms I experienced living in this world. Like, that's where I'm at this point. Like, I live in the world and this is what happens. And it was me, a lot of it was really me doing too much. So I was going to school full time. I was working at the library in computer systems. I was managing a weekly music series, and I was going out partying with all my friends because I had a lot of friends, and I had no idea that I was neurodivergent. we were all kind of weird. So I now know a lot of my friends were neurodivergent. I had no idea. Like, I'm just part of the alternative punk scene, right? And I started just shutting down. I couldn't function. I was out of it at a point. And I became depressed. Back then, you know, there were just a handful of medications, right? There were medications at that point. And I was one of the first kids on my block, right, to get on one of them. And it wasn't the right medication for me. Fast forward to present day, you look at that medication and a lot of the other medications for your typical anxiety and depression. If I do gene testing, it says I shouldn't take those, that they're going to give me, create other issues, other side effects. But that was all I had. I would take one, I would get better, and I'd think, oh, I'm better. I would get off the medication, and everything would be cool for a while because my environment would be cool. And then I would do something like start my first teaching job with high schoolers, you know. And next thing you know, I'm shutting down again, but no one knows what it is, right? Because I'm a woman, I'm smart, I'm not autistic, right? I'm not ADHD. She's depressed. She's anxious. Yeah, I was depressed and I was freaked out because I'm not functioning like I was, right? And it was so confusing. And that went on. That went on for a long time, basically until I started practicing what is in this Self-Care for Autistic People book that I mentioned earlier. Before there was a book, created my own book, my own things, right, that I would do. And then I was good. You know, I eventually moved into software, more like-minded people, worked from home before work from home was a thing, had a baby, would even go part-time as needed. And then I was fine. And it's at that point when you realize, well, wait a second, I'm not crazy. If I'm okay all by myself and I don't even have like a lot of bad thoughts, like I'm not upset. Like, I like my life. You should see my living room. It's amazing. I have lots of cool books and a fireplace, music, and it's very comforting. And, you know, that's when you start realizing, right? Like, there's something else going on here. Fast forward, sometimes as humans, we think, oh, you know, that's all taken care of. I can manage now. And you try to do more interesting things, right? Like, start a practice as a managing director. And then it might hit you like, oh, wait a second, I'm too sensitive. This is a huge meeting of like 25 people and everyone is like vying and they're, you know, long story, Angie, to answer your question. But recently, after going back and finding I am definitely ADHD, that's the thing everyone can agree on. I got on ADHD medication, atomoxetine, Strattera, and it's been amazing. Things I couldn't do before, like drive around and feel comfortable in a busy city. I'm fine if I'm on this medication. I can walk into an arcade and not feel overwhelmed. I can sit on that call of 25 people. And my processing delay that takes me a moment to figure out like when to speak, it's still there, but it's not nearly as bad.
Yeah, I've had a similar experience with the medication thing where I almost felt like I was so anxious. It felt like my head was just wrapped in a bunch of rubber bands and then shoved inside a cloud. You know, so I had this very tense, like, brain fog that happened. And I remember so vividly about 3 weeks after I started taking anxiety medication, kind of waking up one day, taking a deep breath and being like, oh my God, I don't remember when the last time is I actually filled my lungs with air completely. And I have no idea how long it had been, but it felt like the fog cleared. Mm-hmm. And then I could actually participate in my life.
I think that you both bring up your own experiences, obviously, that have been positive. But also, I think it's worth noting, when I first started taking antidepressants, it was when I was in college and I went through like a major, you know, I was in a major pit, I would say. And I knew that I was in trouble and I scared myself that I was so depressed. It's kind of like any other time in my life, actually, I've ever got on medication for one reason or another, it's usually like the last resort because I don't want to do it. And I find out that, well, you could do this or you could die. So that's option B. I mean, what do you want to do?
Oh my God.
And I was kind of in the same place with my depression. I was like, well, so you could do this or die, you know? And I'm like, okay, well, that's a deep, dark thought I don't ever want to have again. So I entertained the idea. And really through counseling and medication, I realized it's not a be-all, end-all solution. It's not an easy button. It's a tool, like, to have in your tool chest. And when you need, you know, tools, you know where they are and you know that you're empowered and you find out what works for you and what doesn't. I haven't had to be on antidepressants for many years now, but I'm not afraid to going back to antidepressants if I ever find myself needing them. And now I know what it looks like and I'm not afraid to go get that tool out of the toolbox. But it took me a long time to get to a place where I was open and accepting. And honestly, some of it I think is control, you know, like the fear that you're not going to have control over your own body, you know, and that something else will. That was a freak out for me and I needed to let it go. But, you know, beyond the medication and therapy, which we all agree is very effective in a positive way, what else affects your ability to manage sensitivities either positively or negatively?
I think for me, what it really comes down to most of the time, it's people. You know, some of the things we've talked about, like different environments, right? The lights and things like that. Those can be annoyances. But I find the most challenging part of life is people. And I have what I will call my kryptonite, right? My kryptonite is toxic or fake people. I can feel people, right? And this is where opinions can diverge. I'm a very feeling person. I can feel the energy in the room. I do believe we're all connected. So for me, you know, when I'm in a room of people, if there's a lot of adversarial behavior or anger, I can't be there. You know, I've left relationships purely because I can't live with this person because their energy, it doesn't work for me. And I tried, and I'm a human being, right? So it isn't always the case. I try my best to be calm. And I am very grateful that at this stage in my life, I have a partner whose energy matches my own, who understands me intuitively. What I really find interesting about my partner is that he's Mexican. He doesn't look like me. We had very different, you know, experiences growing up. He grew up on the south side of Chicago. I grew up in the suburbs. So if this experience isn't an indicator of neurodivergence, I don't know what is. It's not all cultural. It's not all background. It's not race. There's neurodivergence that, you know, can bring us together. It can keep us apart.
So let's talk about sleep for a moment.
What is this thing you're speaking of?
Charisma's laughing at me. I know. Have you found that sleep or lack thereof affects your ability to manage your sensitivities?
Absolutely. Yeah. It really is all about energy. So in our society, based on our culture, you're supposed to be like a smiling, pleasant person with a pleasant voice. And then we have our gender roles and all of that, right? It is very hard for me to adhere to all of that if I am exhausted. And I can get exhausted over time because of the environment, because of the sensitivities. Maybe if I don't sleep. If I don't sleep, you know, I present differently when I don't get enough sleep or rest. Or, you know, whatever it is that maintains my energy.
Okay. Yeah. Angie's constantly telling me, like, I don't know when you sleep. And I'm like, yeah, well, I don't either. Because I hate sleeping. And I've been that way since I was a toddler. And my mom would tell you all kinds of stories. But it's wasting time. And I don't like to waste time. I have so many things to do. And that is one of the hardest things for me personally. I know both, like, there's logic in what you're both saying, and I would agree with you 1,000%.
And we're both shaking our heads at
and
you.
I would not, I do not want to do it, though. I'm like a little kid, like, you can't make me. Like, my husband's like, I'm going to start getting trank darts and just, like, shoot you with a trank dart and let you sleep for 10 hours. I know all three of us have had this conversation before and laughed at one another. But we've all noticed that people can sometimes misinterpret neurodivergent responses. This might be because partly for a long time, there's been a societal emphasis on results or symptoms of neurodivergence versus its cause and effect. Have you noticed this misinterpretation, Charisma? And if so, where do you think it comes from?
No one ever misinterprets anything. I remember it makes me think back to just a couple of years ago, a friend of mine who is also neurodivergent kind of pulled me aside and she was like, Charisma, you need to speak their language. And I was like, but I don't want to. I'm making a point. But we do have different languages. My family, especially my dad, he's an engineer and he's very straightforward in how he communicates. And that's my style as well. That's my default style. I think I really learned how to communicate from him. He's very personable, likes people, you know, gets along well with people, but it's very straightforward. And I think for me, being a woman, it has been very hard because for a long time, I thought that I had a communication problem. And then 3 years ago, when I had the IQ test done and I had my verbal ability tested and I was told, no, you're in the like top 3% for verbal ability. I was like, oh my gosh. So then what is it? Like, it's something different. It's the neurodivergence. It's cultural norms. Right? It's that you shouldn't be too direct. Indirectness is, it's an art. And it's like, Charisma, just take part in the art. And I find the art can be fun. But when you're trying to build technology, design something, clarity, I find more valuable. And I think about my dad and I think about the technologists that I know in the industry, right? In our industry and in the technology industry, in the security industry, industries where being very precise is very important. And I realized that different people have different goals. Some people are trying to get the information and get the alignment and get documented what needs to be documented in order to move things forward. And others maybe are just trying to have a nice meeting. It's just different. Who's wrong? That's a matter of opinion. But it comes down to just differences in goals, I think, differences in communication, maybe some neurodivergence as well. I don't know.
There's so many parallels, by the way, between you, I think all three of us probably, but what you just said about your dad is very parallel to my dad, who was in data security for a very long time. And as a parent, he thought he was doing his job to try to teach me to stop being so emotional. And stop being so dramatic, you know, fit into this square box because this is what is going to be acceptable and what will make you money and what will give you security. And he was doing his best to try to provide and take care of me and protect me. But the side effect is that I completely ignored why I was craving something completely different. And so it was fun in planning this episode with you, Angie, and I know you as well, started talking about, it's so weird when I do fill in the blank behavior, everybody sees something that I totally do not even intend for them to get out of this. We shared some of those. I would love to hear from you both. And I have some examples of my own that maybe people can relate to, like, oh, that sounds like myself, or oh, that sounds like my friend or whomever. And the purpose of sharing this, too, is that we can give each other more grace. And I think the older that you get and the more experience that we get, the more we realize, wow, there's just different perspectives in the world. And I was wrong. I saw that all wrong. And I shouldn't have judged or snapped a conclusion or what have you, or treated somebody one some way. And you would like the same grace to be given to you. So what are some of those things? When I do X, I mean Y.
Oh, I think the big one for me and the one that's sort of like a constant push-pull in my house is clutter anxiety. I grew up in a cluttered house. It really, really stresses me out. Like, I feel like my mental health is directly tied to how much is on my kitchen counters. Little tiny things, too. Like, it, like, threw my whole day off this weekend because my husband didn't fold the bed sheet over the duvet cover when he was making it in the morning. And it stuck with me all day. And I was like, this is not a normal reaction to that.
The horror.
The horror.
Nando makes the bed and he does the folding thing. And I did it the other day just to be nice. And I'm so proud of myself.
Did you do it wrong? Did you do it wrong, Charisma?
No, I didn't. I did it right. I was like, okay.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I'm not allowed to do laundry in our house because my husband might have his own neurodivergence about folding and clothes and how we clean them and how we don't. But it's been funny in our relationship, the things that we both are spastic about, and they're very different. So that's actually works fine with me. I'm happy to have somebody do my laundry for me. So some things that I shared with you guys, and this is, if anybody knows me, you're probably like, yeah, no shit, Brie. I see that all the time. But when I do this, I mean something different. When I'm interrupting a lot, what's actually happening in my mind is not that I'm like, yeah, screw you. I have something better to say and I want to interrupt you now because I'm rude. Like, that's not actually my intention. What's really happening in my brain is I'm hearing you and I'm getting really excited by you and I can't wait to collaborate more. And in fact, I have some other things that I want to run by you because I love what you're saying so much. And that's been something at work that has really gotten me in a lot of trouble in meetings and in things of the like, because I do make very quick decisions. They're not always right. Like, I'm the kid that took the test and got done first, and then I'd make a C. Like, it's not that I have like all the right answers. I can just come to a conclusion really fast, and I need to slow down. And that's been, you know, one of my life lessons for my own growth. Like, Brie, slow down, take a deep breath. You may be very excited about this and you want the other person to remain excited about this too. So you're probably going to have to give them a second to finish what they're saying. Take a breath before you talk. And sometimes I'm good at that. Sometimes I'm not. Another thing I noticed about myself is that I am off topic sometimes. People think like, where the heck did she come up with that? Like, we're over here talking about the blue sky and Brie goes over here and wants to talk about the green grass. You know, usually what's happening in my brain is I'm listening to you and my mind is thinking so quickly ahead, you know, looking down far into the future, what's going to happen next, that I'm already on to something else. Has to do with the same topic, and I'll connect it for you if you're like, what the fur? But that's something that kind of becomes a disconnect and people kind of tune me out. Another one that I actually thought about this a lot last week, I seem antisocial. Brie doesn't want to come to this event, or Brie doesn't want to go to Faces and Names or whatever. And most of the time is that it's because I'm very overwhelmed. And when I really crave meaningful conversations with people, and if there's a whole room of people and I can't possibly either hear anyone to have a meaningful conversation or have a meaningful conversation with everyone that's there, it stresses me the hell out. And I get like super overwhelmed. And I'll start getting very insecure. Like, oh God, like all these people are doing this or all these people are doing that. Like, I'm supposed to be thinking about this or that, or what's my role supposed to be? I'm like, run. Like, it's just not something that I feel comfortable with. Or I'm just exhausted because after, you know, seeing so many people and talking about so many things, my brain needs to like decompress and think about all the stuff, you know, before I can pack some more information in it. And yeah. The last thing I made a note about, and sorry, I just made this about the Brie show, but I'll let you guys talk. But sometimes I get accused of being very negative. Brie, you're really being negative. Why are you poking all the holes and finding all the problems? And that's all you want to talk about. Well, what's really happening inside is I'm so excited about whatever the project is, or I feel very passionate about the workflow or the process or whatever. I care so much about it that I'm sitting here trying to poke all the holes in it because I want to fix the problems before we get to them, because I have a standard of excellence, I do, that I want to uphold in everything that I do. And usually it's a compliment that I actually believe in something so much that I cared enough to poke all the holes, but it does not come across that way. So I have to be very careful about all these tendencies. And I guess I'm lucky. I don't know if that's the right word, to have made so many mistakes and been called out by so many people for their own misinterpretation of Bree Murphy. But I hope that as I learn even more lessons, that I'm able to kind of reverse the side effects of some of this. Does that trigger any thoughts for you guys? Of I use the word trigger, but does that make you think of anything?
Yeah. I've experienced all of those things. All of them. Yeah. It's interesting. The interrupting is the hardest for me. It's a little easier with ADHD medication, but it's still difficult. And that's because my friends, my family, Nando, we don't see it the same way. Like, no one has the floor. I see things as a collaboration, and I want people's information, and I'm often trying to help. I remember a boss of mine who is neurodivergent once defending me. She's just excited. She's just excited. General counsel, don't be offended. Like, whoops.
That's a nice bias.
Yeah. But I mean, it's not the only thing going on, right? Sometimes someone will have a premise, or they'll have something that they're talking about, and they're going in a direction. And I know it's the wrong direction. I know they haven't thought about X. Mm-hmm. And I want to help, because time is important. And we're on a call, and it's a 30-minute call. And we've spent like 10 minutes of or 15 minutes of the 30-minute call going in this wrong direction. And I haven't been able to get a word in edgewise because I have a processing delay. And it's like there's no space, and I can't get the opening. Because I need like a big opening in order for my brain and the words to come out in the right time.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. Both of you have raised this element of time and like feeling very cognizant about time, which is another one that I've experienced. Like sometimes, you know, I'll sort of steer a meeting or maybe come across as pretty curt or rude or unfeeling or something like that. And it's often either like I'm having stomach problems, or I'm stressed about time. And like, I mm-hmm. see that we are so many minutes into this meeting, and I know outcome. We have X amount of ground. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
interested in a good outcome.
Yeah.
What I've read somewhere is that neurotypical generally, they're interested in just having a nice meeting. What's funny is I find that adverse to actually caring about the outcome sometimes. Like we could either A, have a great meeting, and accomplish nothing.
Yeah.
Everyone's super nice and no one talks about anything important.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there's no, none of me looking ahead and talking about how the grass is green or whatever. Right. Because that's the thing I wanted to come back to, Pri. We can have a nice meeting where we're all in sync. Right. Or we can actually get this thing done. One of my biggest issues, and it's, I don't know how I'm so blind to it. Maybe it's because no one told me I was smart when I was young. And I just found out like 2 years ago. I will see something that is so obvious to me. It's like, oh, well, we need to do X. And I don't realize that I've just made this, because I'm not a linear thinker.
Mm-hmm.
I've made this leap from point A to point like G in like a moment. And I'm like, oh, this. And everyone's like, she's crazy. What is she even talking about? And then it'll usually take like months. And then the group arrives at that thing. And I don't know what to do about that, because I don't actually have the information related to how I got from A to G. I just know G is true.
Yeah. Well, and I've had that happen so many times, Charisma, that exact same situation. But I get, of course, in my fashion, I get angry because I try in about 10 different ways to communicate the same thought. And I'm thinking, I'm not a stupid person. I know how to communicate. I have a speech communications degree. I mean, for the love of God, why can they not see this? And then they finally come to the conclusion and somebody else gets the credit for it. I'm like, the fuck is that? What just happened? Like, I told you guys this 3 months ago. And one thing I've learned for myself anyway is, look, this has repeated itself enough in your life that you need to know that this is not going to stop and you need to chill out and make it not about Brie. And maybe, just maybe, they came to that conclusion because you planted a seed that you watered and then you watered it again and you watered it again. And if somebody else gets the credit, then somebody else gets the credit, because the end game is that you actually needed for this thing to happen, and it did. And stop trying to find your personal value and getting the accolades for your conclusion being bound. Yeah. Get your value somewhere else. And that's once you start trying to get your value from a different place, that's not your team giving you accolades or whatever, whatever unhealthy way that you're trying to do that, it's freeing. Then you feel like, okay, I'm so happy that we came up with this conclusion, guys. You guys are all geniuses. And then move on. But gosh, that's a repeated pattern I see in my life a lot.
The ego is amazing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something I study a lot, like looking at it, trying to understand it, letting go of it, right? It really is. It's funny, that sense of self and that ego, it's to blame for everything, all of the wars, all of the things that hold us back from enjoying the current moment and our lives. And I've tried to do my best to recognize I only have one life, and perception is what I make it. And I think having so much chaos when I was in my 20s and coming out of it and recognizing that perception is just perception, right? Because I've experienced different kind of moods and elements. You let it go. You can let it go and you can just go have a nice time at dinner.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much easier said than done sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know. Sometimes I get stuck.
I want to make some space here for us to wrap up with, like, what's your, like, give us a final thought. I think it'd be fun for all of us to go around and, like, say our final thought on this topic.
I would say, I think something that I just want people to understand are the principles in this Self-Care for Autistic People book by Dr. Megan Anna Neff. It's important, super important. Without the self-care, you might not be able to sleep. You might be all stressed out, not enjoy your life as much, and you know you've only got one.
That's a great final thought. I mean, I feel very convicted of a lot of my own shortcomings when we talk about this subject, to be honest. The other thing that I would say is try as much as you can to understand who you are. Not, and that doesn't mean just your own maybe neurodivergence or neurotypical or wherever you fall on whatever spectrum, but also has a lot to do with things that Charisma talked about earlier, where you come from, how were you raised? You know, I come from a past of a lot of different traumas in a lot of different places. Working through all those things in my life has been essential for me to find peace and also for me to find myself. I would say that I'm a late bloomer and maybe I haven't even completely found myself yet, but I didn't walk around life confident knowing who I was or accepting myself. And I feel like I'm doing more of that in this stage and this season. And I feel so much happier and whole. And I feel that I spend my days fulfilling my ultimate purpose. And that's a really great feeling. But as much as you can, just start picking your own self apart, just to kind of develop your own sense of understanding and acceptance of you, because you are who you are for a reason, and you are unique and wonderful in your own way. And you've got to know that.
Yeah. My parting word to any of our listeners is there's no right journey here. I figured out my neurodivergence and then how to manage it through trial and error without any family support, with a family who really, to this day, I think finds some shame in it. And I've, you know, scaled up my medication and therapy and scaled it down, and depends on what my external inputs are for me. But there's no right journey, and have grace for anybody in your life who might be going through theirs.
So. I'm going to say one more thing. So now I'm totally breaking the rules. And I get that. But I'd also say find like-minded souls somewhere, because, you know, hanging out with Charisma and hanging out with Angie always brings me so much joy in my heart, because I see myself in them, and then I see greatness in them that I achieve for myself. I would like to achieve for myself. They inspire me to be better. And it's nice to be in an environment where you're allowed to be you. And so I really thank you, Charisma, for coming on today and sharing your heart and sharing your journey. And I just am so grateful that I'm able to be in your life at all, and in all the ways that I am. And I just very much appreciate you taking the time and preparing for this and your time for being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us on eDiscovery Chicks. We hoped you learned something new, felt empowered, or just had some fun along the way. Don't forget to join the flock by following us on LinkedIn and Instagram, and check out our website, ediscoverychicks.com. If you loved this episode, share it with your network, please leave us a review, or tag us on your socials with your favorite takeaway. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Until next time, flock on, friends.
The views we've expressed today are the eDiscovery Chicks views and don't necessarily represent the views of our employers, partners, or clients. The podcast is available solely for educational purposes to provide general information about eDiscovery principles and not to provide legal advice to any specific situation. It is not a substitute for legal advice from a lawyer, or maybe I should say medical advice from a psychologist that you've retained who has agreed to represent or help you. Until next time, bye guys.
Bye.